This is Liz Scafidi at UN News. We need more women in power positions, the outgoing president of the 73rd General Assembly, Maria Fernanda Espinosa, has told UN News, saying that gender parity and women's rights are not only about justice, but about common sense. The president, or PGA, as insiders refer to those in the job, hands the gavel over on Tuesday and said she wished she had longer to tackle issues that she believes need further development, including bolder reform on how the General Assembly operates. We need to look at how to implement and transform our resolutions into improving the lives of people on the ground, she said. Ms. Espinosa looked back at her year in office with UN News' Eleuterio Guavain.
I would say very intense, a lot of hard work, but a lot of achievements, a lot of satisfaction in a job that is so immense and where there were so many expectations because people expect a lot from the UN. So I am very satisfied with the traction, the support of member states, and that we were able to deliver on the 7 priorities that we set up at the beginning.
And what would you say have been your major achievements in the office?
That I delivered on the 7 issues that I put forward as priorities, but perhaps highlight 3. Our global plastics campaign that ended up phasing out single-use plastics at the UN headquarters, but also bringing together more than 400 million people that now are aware that we are killing our oceans with single-use plastics, a campaign that had impact on governments of the Caribbean that decided to come together and phase out single-use plastics. The other issue that I can highlight is my obsession on gender equality, women empowerment, and women's rights. Everything I have done, every trip, every high-level event, every discussion, negotiation has had the issue of women empowerment and gender parity at the core. I set up a group of gender advisors from different regions, and they have been doing the oversight of my work as president. So we brought a lot of women in power to the work of the General Assembly and outside of the General Assembly.
Is there anything you would have done differently with hindsight?
I would say that I would have liked to have more time for some issues that I think need further development. For example, to be bolder and more ambitious in how we improve the working methods of the General Assembly, how we mainstream our work, how we modernize our work, how we put more emphasis on implementation than on resolution making. This year, we are going to approve about 340 resolutions at the end of the session, and I think we should look at implementation. There is a lot of negotiations to come up with a resolution, even more so when you adopt resolutions by consensus, 193 member states coming together on an issue. But we need to look at how to implement and how to transform our resolutions, our rulemaking exercise, into improving the lives of people on the ground.
And what are your thoughts on being one of just a handful of women who have occupied this position and being also the first woman from South America in this function?
It was both a privilege and a challenge because I knew I had to deliver. I knew I had to prove that I was elected by member states because I was the right person, and number 2, because also I was a woman. So I think that basically the message is that we do need more women in power positions. We cannot continue to have 75% of parliamentarians still men, only 21 heads of state and government among 193, less than 5% of women CEOs in the 500 biggest companies. So the numbers are not right, which means that the quality of governance is not right. Gender parity and women's rights is only about justice. It's about common sense, it's about arithmetics, but also about quality of a society, of a democracy, even the delivery on the sustainable development goals. Women need to be at the heart and center of all the public policy, the legislative efforts, and the ground efforts also in local governments at the very small household level until the very big international level. But there's a lot to be done still because women and girls are still marginalized. If you look at the last report of the Sustainable Development Goals, we see that inequalities have grown, and the umbrella of the inequalities is in women and girls inequality.
So what else can the UN do to advance the agenda of women throughout the world?
I would say that there is a combination of actions. First of all, we need strong global leadership. We need proper legal frameworks. We need strong networks from civil society working in conjunction, but also connecting the thinking, the pledges, and the commitments worldwide. But also, it is in the hands of governments and leaders. I mentioned global leadership. I mentioned very specific affirmative action policy and legislation, and also investment. We need to invest more on good quality education for girls and boys. We need to invest more in making sure that the salary gap between men and women disappears. It's 20% salary gap worldwide. So there is a lot of work to be done still on the economic empowerment of women, on having more women in positions of power, women in politics, work with rural women that are very much the owners of our own food security for today and the future. We need to do more with women with disabilities, with indigenous women. They have to be at the center of our commitments to deliver on the 2030 agenda.
On peace and security, what will you say to someone who questions the role or the relevance of the United Nations today in the face of conflicts such as Syria, Yemen, we have the Israel-Palestinian issue that remain unresolved?
Well, when I travel, I always engage with young people, with youth groups, women's groups. They always ask the UN to deliver, and it's fair enough. But the UN, it's all of us together, working together. And it is true that we have conflicts that are now increasing in proportion, increasing in intensity, and increasing also in paralysis, some of them. We have to acknowledge, for example, that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, it's a little bit in a frozen state. And I think that what we need to do is overcome this implementation and delivery deficit that we have, because we have several resolutions at the Security Council, several resolutions of the General Assembly. It is about time that we put them in motion. And I think that the UN is the only place where political dialogue with peaceful solutions to conflicts, even protracted conflicts, can be addressed and resolved. Because here it is the home of the United Nations, but also of we the peoples. Let's not forget this very first powerful phrase of the UN Charter.
During your mandate, two pacts were approved on refugees and migrants. We still have crisis in Europe with migrants and also in South Africa. What will be vital for effective action to avoid this crisis?
I would say that both compacts, the Global Compact on Migration and the Global Compact on Refugees, are both instruments to foster and enhance cooperation, collaboration, and dialogue among member states and among societies worldwide. So they're not legally binding instruments, they're policy guidance tools, and they need to be used widely. And the second issue is that both compacts, they look at the root causes, a preventive agenda. The only way to prevent to increase in the number of refugees and migrants is to look at the root causes. Root causes are poverty, inequality, bad quality education, lack of job opportunities for young people, but also conflict and insecurity. So if we tackle that, if we are serious about implementing the 2030 agenda, I think it's the most powerful tool to build peaceful societies. The history of migration is the history of humanity. We have always had migrants, people on the move. I think it is important to have shared responsibilities and burden sharing between countries of origin, transit, and destination. And that's what the Compact on Safe, Orderly, and Regular Migration does.
You just told us about young people. We have seen more people attending UN events actively. How should other groups be promoted in the organization as well?
I think that we do have an inclusion deficit at the UN. And I have tried to overcome this inclusion deficit in a way. Young people have been part and parcel of everything that I have done this year. Every high-level event, every high-level dialogue, every engagement, even at the presidential level. It's not that we invited young people. They were part of the discussion. They were part of the table, interacting with ministers, heads of state and government. We have also engaged women's groups, civil society organizations. And I think it is imperative that we improve the way we include all stakeholders in the conversation and in the discussion. We know that the UN is an intergovernmental space, but we cannot take informed decisions as member states if we are not ready to listen. I think the secret of taking informed decisions is by listening to what society, the society we represent, is telling us as leaders, as decision makers.
Let's go back to the environment and talk about an experience you had in the Caribbean. How do you expect the campaign on plastic to have more efficiency and impact throughout the world?
It will continue, I am sure, because we have had so many excellent partners, starting from celebrities to the private sector engaged, leaders, starting by the Prime Minister of Antigua and Barbuda, the high authorities of Norway. Member states are coming together to really be serious about phasing out single-use plastics. And societies, young people, our Played Out concert in Antigua and the campaign gathered more than 400 million people. We strengthened our partnership with National Geographic. So it was a huge network in which the UN is at the center, the Office of the President, but also UN Environment. So we have planted the seeds, and I am sure that seeds are going to really have a great harvest.
And as a poet, what you wrote or found that resonated with you throughout the tenure?
This year, as I have done in the entire adult life, I didn't stop reading poetry. My writing has suffered a little bit, I have to acknowledge, but I have so much, I have learned so much. I have received so much love from people that I'm sure that this is going to one day be reverted into poetry. But I have read poetry. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to write. But it is somewhere in my heart and in my mind, in my DNA. I mean, poetry is in my DNA. It's part of what I am. So it will come, hopefully soon.
Any final thoughts?
This has been perhaps the most fascinating, wonderful, professional and human experience that I have ever had in my life.